Good morning. It is Sunday, March 25th, 2012. The topic for today's class is for current Jewish questions, the solutions to the Aguna problem. Last week we went through the original sources of exactly what is the Aguna problem, how did it, not just how did it come about, but what are the halachic underpinnings behind it. We normally go around and read, I ask people to read. There's a lot of stuff today, so I'm going to drive most of the shiur. We're still going to have time for discussion, but I want to make sure that it's going to stay focused and cover, what we need to cover, especially because it does get a little complicated. So first, just as a very quick recap of what we saw last week, the main source, like biblical sources relevant to the Aguna problem, is Devarim, Deuteronomy 24:1-2, which establishes that in order for a woman to get divorced from her husband, the husband is the one who has to give this bill of divorce to his wife. And Leviticus Vayikra 20:10 says that, if a woman commits adultery, if a woman who is still halachically married goes and has a relationship with another man, then both the woman and the man are liable for the death penalty. So the three things that really are, we need to keep in mind here is the husband must give the wife a get, he must do so willingly, and three, halachically illegal coercion invalidates the get. And last week we spent some time talking about the coercion aspect. So the risk is, the risk is permitting a married woman to another man, in which case violating a biblical offense and creating mamzer. Something else to keep in mind here are what are the different types of agunot. So I put down three different categories. One is the recalcitrant husband, which is probably the most, most common, but it's certainly one that evokes the greatest ire, because you've got a spiteful husband who doesn't want to give his wife a get. So how do you get him to give a wife a get? Two is you can have a missing husband, where his location is unknown. He's an MIA from a war. He could be lost at sea. Happened after 9/11. You had a lot of people whose were just unknown whereabouts, and you didn't have actual definitive proof. Were they there? Were they not there? Where they could be willing to give their wife a get, in theory, but they're just unavailable. You don't know where they are. And finally, you have diminished faculty, such as someone who's deaf, mute, dementia. He loses the halachic capacity to voluntarily give his wife a get due to a lack of mental competency. So in terms of understanding the solutions, there are three things to consider. One is, how does the solution work halachically to free the woman from the marriage without the illegal coercion of a get? Right? And by illegal coercion, I mean, it's one of the cases that we saw last week of like when you, a Beit Din would be permitted or not permitted to actually force. So assuming that there's no halachically illegal coercion, because that would invalidate it. Two is, what are the limitations? What problems does it not solve? And that's an important distinction. Of the solutions that we're going to see today, some of them would take care of every possible case. Some of them would only take care of certain cases. Like, say, the halachic prenup only works for a recalcitrant husband. It's not going to be effective if someone's missing. Right? So that, I would say, is a limitation. But the third category of things to consider are flaws, which are inherent deficiencies inherent in the proposed solution. Either there's a halachic flaw, or there's something else that's an integral problem with what's being suggested. Okay? Got that quick summary so far? All right. So the first category, actually, we may go around with some of these things. Retroactive types of solutions, which I summarized here, is through an action in the present, you retroactively end the marriage in such a way that the marriage would have never even existed. Right? It's a, it's called a complete annulment. It's what, like, today, there are certain states that have laws about an annulment of a marriage, where, like, if a marriage isn't consummated, you can say, well, this just never was a marriage at all. Right? In which case, you don't have a divorce, but it's, you were never married. So, in Hebrew, this is called Hafka'at Kiddushin, which is the, uprooting of the marriage. Again, such that you were never married. This was the discussion, subject of a debate that I included here between Rabbi Shlomo Riskin of Efrat and Rabbi Jeremy Weider, who's now Rosh Yeshiva at YU, I believe. By now both, Rabbi Riskin, certainly I believe Rabbi Weider, when I should have, completed his PhD in Talmud from NYU. So you're not just talking about, right-wing types on either side. You're talking about, people who have rabbinic backgrounds. Rabbi Riskin is a YU musmach. People who actually thought about this seriously. It's actually, please, you know what, do the first one. This is Bava Batra 48a. First type of Hafka'at Kiddushin example that we find is if there was some sort of flaw in the marriage ceremony itself.
Amar has laid down that if a woman consents to betroth herself under pressure of physical violence, the betrothal is valid. Admar, son of Rab Ashi, however, said, in the case of a woman, the betrothal is certainly not valid. He treated the woman cavalierly, and therefore the rabbis treat him cavalierly and nullify his betrothal. And Rabinus.
All right. Yeah. Okay. Actually, hold up on that last part because we'll see that. You know, it's worth explaining that last part in a second. But stop just from here. According to the Gemara in Bava Batra 48a, the problem is of a coerced type of wedding, which is considered to be lok shalokahogan. It's acting inappropriately. So the rabbis act inappropriately, and they say, "Well, this wedding was not a valid wedding." It's a way of saying that there's a problem in the... I mean, it's a weird type of way of saying afki'inu kiddushin, even though the mechanics of, like, well, giving his, you know, doing the procedure to get married. It's worthwhile explaining here. According to the Gemara, it's actually first Mishnah in Kiddushin, there are three ways that a woman gets halachically married. Kesef, Shtar, and Bia. One is Kesef, which is the giving over a certain amount of money. Virtually all weddings today are Kiddushe Kesef, are done with a certain item of monetary value. Today, it's the ring. And if, you know, some Misader Kedushin, some officiating rabbis will actually ask someone, do you consent that this ring is worth this minimal value, like a Sheva Pruta? And that ring gets given over, and that's called Kedushe Kesef. You also have Kedushe Shtar, which I don't know if that's ever done these days, where you actually, like, write on a sheet of paper, you know, Hareyat Mikudeshet Li, like, behold, you're betrothed to me, and give it over. I don't know anyone who does that, but that's on the list, too. And finally, you have Kedushe Bia, where through an actual act of intercourse, you could, in fact, be halakhically married to a woman. It goes against the Gemara. I mean, they're really not big fans of it, but it is enough to take effect. There was a joke, I believe, said in the name of Ben-Gurion, where they asked him if he had a Jewish wedding, and he said, lo haya kesef, lo haya shtar. That there wasn't the money and there wasn't the contract. And, you know, back in the day, Chilonim were, you know, knowledgeable enough to make that joke. So in terms of going back to certain, you know, flaws to the wedding, Rabbi Riskin, in his piece on Hafkat Kiddushin, does a very brief summary of positions from Rav Moshe Feinstein, where he says, this is quoting from Rabbi Riskin, it would appear from the response of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein that four conditions must be met in order to declare a marriage invalid for having arisen in error. One, a heretofore unknown blemish must have already existed at the time of the marriage. Two, the unknown factor only came to the party's attention after the marriage had already taken place. Three, the previously unknown factor affects the essence of the marital bond, such as impotence, or is a major defect that makes it impossible to live with the affective partner, such as mental deficiency. And four, the unknown factor is a matter that would seriously vex most people and deter them from marrying the affected partner had they known about the matter from the outset. So one way of saying if certain ideas are, like, let's say, the principle behind most of these is something called nekach ta'ut, of a mistaken sale, that if a woman enters into a marriage, and there was knowledge, or at least there was a certain information where, had she known about this beforehand, wouldn't have entered into the marriage, then that is a way of, you know, that can sometimes, in these four conditions, provide grounds for saying, since you got married under false pretenses, your marriage has no halachic standing. Because you're a woman, in order to get halachic married, needs her will and consent and knowledge that she's getting into the marriage. But if it's done because she doesn't, you know, if you're dealing with a case where not everything was fully disclosed, that could be an exception to say this marriage never in fact took place and could be a way of ending the marriage. I threw in my own little note here of another way of doing hafka'ah, sort of retroactively this way for a flaw, is, like, let's say, you know, there's an aguna case. So one thing that a rabbi might do is say, well, who are your eidei kedushin? Who are the witnesses that act, you know, at the wedding? So, like, another strategy would be, that's not included here, is to say, well, maybe there was a halachic law in the marriage itself. If the witnesses weren't kosher, say, your wedding wasn't kosher. Right? So it's a little bit riskier to do that, you know, for other reasons, but whatever.
That's what Rabbi Riskin did. He said one of them wasn't Shomer Shabbos. So
that's, you know, so that type of hafka. I mean, the Gemara doesn't use that language of hafka'ah, but that's still the actual effect of what someone does. He also wasn't the only one for that. I mean, that is not an uncommon strategy that people try. It's just not always so easy to pull that off. The thing that Rabbi Riskin tried promoting more in, this was an article that he wrote in Tradition in 2002, is Hafka'at Kiddushin based on, when there wasn't an intrinsic flaw in the wedding, but rather something later on in marriage. And the basis for this are, couple of Gemaras in Gittin. One is a Mishnah in Gittin 4:2. It's important to start there. It says, in former times, a man was allowed to bring together a beitin whenever he was and cancel the get, which was sent by messenger to his wife. Rabban Gamliel, however, laid down the rule that said this should not be done so as to prevent abuses. Literally, it's to repair the world, tikkun olam. Here's the scenario. I, as a husband, let's say I'm separated from my wife. If I want to divorce my wife, technically, I have to put it in her hand. However, I'm also allowed to send a shaliach, a messenger or an agent. So case is this. Let's say I hire a messenger. I hire you. You go over to send the get away. As long as the get is still in transit, technically speaking, I'm allowed to be mevatel the get. I'm allowed to say, that get that I just sent out, it's nothing anymore. Rabban Gamliel said, can't do that anymore because of tikkun olam. All right, that's the Mishnah. Gemara in Gittin 33a elaborates, says, what does this refer to? Rav Yochanan said, to prevent illegitimacy. It's going to prevent mamzerim. Why? Because if the woman gets the get, she doesn't know I was mevatel, that she's going to go and remarry, even though halachically, I mean, she can even show like a rabbi saying, look, I have a get. And there's no way for her to know that the husband was mevatel it. Right, so Reish Lakish said to prevent wife desertion. Says mipenei takanat agunot, that it is a problem here specifically for to avoid agunot. For he held with Rav Nachman, who said that the get could be canceled before a beitin of two. A beitin of two. The proceedings of two are not generally known. So she, not having heard and not knowing that the get is canceled, might go and marry again and bear legitimate children. Reish Lakish said to prevent wife desertion. For he held with Rav Sheshet, who said that he has to cancel it before a beitin of three, which of whether or not the beitin you're doing is two or three people. So he said three. So the proceedings of three are generally known. So hearing it and knowing that the get was canceled would remain unmarried and therefore have to save her from being a deserted wife. Hence the enactment of Rabban Gamliel. Okay. So our rabbis have taught, if the husband did cancel the get before a beit din, it is canceled, in spite of the regulation in Rav Shimon ben Gamliel. I mean, Rav Shimon ben Gamliel said, don't do it. But if you did it, right, then it still would be halachically okay. Right? So this is the ruling of Rabbi. Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, however, said that he can neither cancel it nor add any additional conditions, since if so, what becomes the authority of the beis din? Meaning the beis din of Rabban Gamliel that made the regulation. Meaning the very fact that Rabban Gamliel said, don't do it because of tikkun olam, if he does it anyway and it still has halachic value, then what's the point of Rabban Gamliel's original takana?
He's also protecting his father.
There is that element too, right? Notice how he says, what's the authority of the beis din? Yes, that is a very good point there. And is it possible then that where a get, according to the written law, is canceled, meaning biblically speaking, the get would be null and void, right? We should, to save the authority of the beit din, declare it valid and allow a married woman to marry another. That's a pretty big chidush. That's a pretty big innovation. Biblically speaking, she'd still be married, and yet Chazal basically come in and say, yeah, you're no longer married. How do you do that? Just for the purposes of protecting the beis din, or can you do it? So it says yes. Why? Do it in the Aramaic here. Called Mekadesh, Ada'ata Rabbanan Mekadesh. Whoever gets married does so under the authority of the rabbis. The Afki'inu Rabbanan Likidushin Mine. And the rabbis can undo the marriage. So how does this work? Said Ravina to Ravashi, this is quite right if the husband had originally betrothed his wife with money, which would mean transforming retrospectively the money of the betrothal given to the woman at the first marriage into an ordinary gift. According, this is the Cencino's explanation here. A beit din has a very interesting rule called hefker beiting hefker. A beit din has the ability to take someone's property and make it ownerless. You can understand why this could be rampant abuse, but you know, go with me for a second here. So according to this opinion, what a Beis Din can do is go back in time and say that money that the husband gave to the wife in terms of Kedushe Kesef, right, like the ring, they can go back in time and say that ring is Hefker, which means he never actually acquired her. He didn't give her money, and therefore the wedding is not halachically good at all. Right, so that summarizes the note here. The rabbis declared the act of marriage to be retrospectively non-marital. Right? There were a few brackets here. Got to follow here. From the moment the divorce is right. Since Hefker was a Beit Din, that's impaired the original betrothal. Right, but if you had betrothed her by the act of marriage, which would really, since English translation, to be intercourse. Let's say they did Kiddushei Bia. What can we say? So the rabbis declare the act retrospectively non-marital, meaning from the moment a divorce is annulled in such a matter, the cohabitation it was ordained must assume retrospectively the character of mere intercourse. So here's the scenario. To do Kiddushei Bia, right, to have actual Kiddushin with intercourse, you would need to have you'd have to have witnesses on the outside. You would have to tell the witnesses, here's what we're about to do, and that sort of thing. And here the sages are even getting up and saying that intercourse, we're going to treat that as not actually l'shem kiddushin. That's just stam intercourse. They call it bi'ilat zanut. It's like any other, you just were basically fooling around. Uh-huh. Which is remarkable. Uh-huh. You think about it, Hefker Beit Din Hefker is at least an extant, halakhic principle. You go around here saying, even though the original Ma'aseh Kiddushin, the act of Kiddushin was, legitimate, it's something like, we're going to pretend it's not. Yeah.
Why wouldn't they say the Adim were not qualified?
It's a good question. Maybe it's harder to do. Well, so I'll tell you one reason why it's difficult to say retroactively the Adim weren't good. It would be through an opinion that says you would need a Ma'aseh Beit Din, you would need an act in a court to invalidate witnesses. Meaning just because, I saw someone do Chilul Shabbat, you would need to actually have someone testify in court to that fact such that the person would lose the halachic status. Not so simple there, at least back then. So
involves two real people too that you might
right.
Be,
so
answering this person.
So that's one case of Hafka'at Kiddushin where the guy sends the get to his wife. He's mevatel the get, and the rabbis say, we're treating you as divorced anyway. Another example of Hafgat Kiddushin because of something weird in the divorce proceedings comes later on in Gittin, on 73a, regarding someone who's about to die and gives his wife a get. It says here, are we to understand that this gift from a sick person who passes from one illness is valid? Yes, and Rav Elazar said in the name of Rav, the gift of a sick person who passes from one illness into another is valid. Rabba and Rava did not concur in this opinion of Rav Huna, as they were afraid it might lead people to think that a get could be given after death. But is it possible that where a get is invalid according to the Torah because the condition that he should die is not fulfilled, we should fear of misleading people, declare it effective for making a married woman marriageable? Yes, again, same principle. Whoever gets married does so under the authority of the rabbi. So the case is someone's about to die, gives his wife a get, say, either on condition or some condition that's dependent, clearly understandable on his death, and he gets better or he goes back, and becomes ill again. According to this, it's treated as if the get is, we were saying here's a time where they will actually apply Hafka'at Kiddushin. Why? Because you don't want people to say, you could either give a get after a divorce, or that the get was somehow, there was something weird with the get. It causes too much confusion. Based on these two sources, here is Rabbi Riskin's words on a more generalized Hafka'at Kiddushin. He says, this is writing in Tradition in 2002, it is my opinion that in the difficult times lie today, the truth is with these I had to copy and paste and some of the let me just come on up so I can do a Cassius, I copied and pasted this from a PDF that had to do some emendations. When many women are forced to live as agunot chained to their husbands, and recalcitrant husbands are taking advantage of their wives, as well as abusing the halacha to hold up their wives for ransom or preventing them from marrying, there are certainly grounds to make use of the opinion of Hafka'at Kiddushin even without a get. But with an explicit enactment, this would release those women from their change from from an almost certain life of sin. This is especially so in the problem of agonot, causes such great human suffering and degradation of halacha. But this can only be done by a large gathering of rabbis of Israel who must decide on the matter, so that many authorities shall share the burden of this decision, and the Torah not become like two Torahs. Much thought is needed in order to carefully define the circumstances in which Hafka'ah would be implemented, as well as to formulate the stipulation that would have to be added at the time of betrothal. My suggestion would be the chief rabbinate in Jerusalem adopt an enactment stipulating that if a religious court orders a husband to divorce his wife, and he refuses to do so, even after sanctions have been imposed on him, then a special court should be established with the authority to cancel his marriage and free his wife to remarry. So, according to Rabbi Shlomo Riskin, based on, this is only one paragraph of, you can imagine, a much longer article, where he goes through, Rishonim and various other interpretations of Hakafka Ad Kiddushin. He wants to make it a policy level. And is trying to advocate here for a wide range of acceptance. And he makes a very legitimate point where if one group does Hafka'a Kiddushin, if one person has a solution to the Aguna problem that isn't accepted by another group, right, then you have, as he put it, the Torah becomes like two Torahs, which was a Talmudic idiom describing the schism between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. And here you'd even have like two groups of Jews, because they say, well, we can't marry into this group because they're mamzer. They rely on this dispensation that would permit a married woman to marry other people. That's not good. And if this is what they rely on, we can't intermarry with them at all. Now, he threw in a certain line here, which
if the couple already had children,
yeah,
and their marriage is now nullified,
yes,
right, are those children mamzerim?
No. Now, it's a great, that is a wonderful question. Having children out of wedlock does not make the children mamzerim. The only thing that makes them mamzerim is if the union, there was a problem with the union itself. It was a married woman if a married woman had children from another man that wasn't her husband. That would be a mamzer. Incest might be a mamzer, but if you just had a random pregnancy from two people who weren't married, no, that would not be a case of mamzerim. Now, he threw in an important line here that Rabbi Jeremy Weider disagreed with, and they actually went back and forth for a few articles in tradition about this. And he put in the parentheses here, to make use of the option of Hafka'at Kiddushin even without a get. As Rabbi Weider points out, it's not that he points out, I think Rabbi Riskin was aware of this, but Rabbi Weider focuses on this point, that the Gemaras that we saw that deal with Hafka'a Kiddushin, you've got one that saw a flaw in the marriage, but not talking about that side, talking about some flaw in the divorce proceeding, both involve the issuance of a get. Right? One case is the guy sent a wife a get and tried to be mevatel it. The other is he's giving a get on his deathbed. In both cases, you've got, you don't have, and as he writes here, the underlying part I have in Rabbi Jeremy Rissing is that he actually had 3 points. One is that the area of ishut of marriage, there is a long established tendency to be stringent in all elements that touch upon the possibility of a married woman remarrying without a proper get. So that we've already discussed at length, both between now and last week. Number two, underlined here, there is no precedent in halachic literature for retroactive annulment without a get. And again, I should point out that this is part of a much longer article on Rabbi Weider, but this line is underlined here is basically the essence of his argument. And I apologize if either one is listening if I'm oversimplifying it, but that's kind of the essence here. Do you say, you could view it this way, according to Rabbi Riskin, once you have the solution established by the sages, that this thing of Hafka'at Kiddushin does in fact exist, where the sages have this halachic mechanism by which they can go back in time and retroactively annul the marriage, well then we should be able to apply it, whenever today. According to Rabbi Weider, taking a more, a more minimalist position, is that Hafka'at Kiddushin has to work through some halachic mechanism. And how did this work in the time of the Gemara? Well, it worked because there was actually some get there. And there's a discussion about what role the get, in fact, plays in this whole equation. But Rabbi Weider's point is it's never found without a get. Not only that, but there is no precedent at all for any sort of annulment if there wasn't a get. And this is talking about something where no one doubts the validity of the marriage, Right? It's, you know, if people doubted the validity of the marriage, that would be one thing. But no one says, like, oh, everything was fine up until the marriage, and now we're just going to go back in time and undo the wedding. Right? The other issue, which I don't recall either one of them discussing, is what Beit Din today would have the authority to, you know, even go through this, to do Hefker Beit Din Hefker. That is a much bigger question in Choshen Mishpat about what is the authority of a contemporary Beit Din today, and whether or not Hefker Beit Din Hefker or anything else like Hefkat Kedushin, you know, whether or not we have the jurisdiction today to even do that huge, huge other question, which they don't even get into. Okay, so that summarizes a bit of the Hefkat Kedushin issue. Fine. A few others. Now that, you know, the advantage to Hefkat Kedushin, if it works, is since it's a retroactive solution that could be employed at any time in the marriage. It'll solve virtually every. If you follow Rabbi Riskin, it could, in theory, be applied to every single instance of an aguna. All those three cases, right? Whether or not it's a recalcitrant husband, whether or not the husband is MIA, whether or not diminished capacity, right? All of those, it would work. All right. The more common ones that developed, over time, since I think historically Rabbi Weider is. I happen to be more convinced by Rabbi Weider's arguments. I know I included more of it, the essays here that we're reading, but it seems that Rishonim, throughout Jewish history, were not big fans of actually employing Hefkat Kedushin. The next category that we're going to spend more time on are what I call preemptive solutions. These would be solutions to the aguna problem that you try to do something at the time of the wedding that would make it easier, or somehow do something that would enable giving a get or having some sort of separation to be significantly easier. So the first one that I want to do with is designating divorce agents at the wedding itself. This was proposed by Rabbi Louis Epstein in 1930 from the textures from the proceedings of the Rabbinical Assembly. So at the time, stands to reason, he was affiliated with the conservative movement in 1930. Bill, you mind reading 2:1 for us? This is, again, his article, the citations of which are in the works cite at the last page. But here's Rabbi Louis Epstein writing in 1930.
We have applied ourselves to this problem, keeping in mind one objective, to invest the court with the power of granting a divorce to the wife without the consent and in the absence of the husband. We find that this is possible on the basis of existing halacha. It may be achieved by the husband's making out an instrument at the time of the marriage, authorizing the court to grant his wife a divorce in his absence, and appointing the necessary agents and witnesses for this purpose.
That's the kunz of this. Like, this is a real ikar here, as I understand it. At the time of the wedding, here's how it's going to work. There's some rabbinic court, and I say, you guys, you're my agents to write my get for my wife. Go ahead and do it. So what happens? Let's say, 50 years down the line, wedding's not so good, and, goes to the institution and say, oh, I know my father, not my father, I know my husband set you up as his agent to give me a get. Could you go ahead and give me the get now? So that way,
this is between World War I and World War II.
Yes. And in fact, it was done largely in response to MIAs from World War I. Ahead of it, but the operative thing here is I should have underlined that too. It's without the consent and in the absence of the husband, because once the husband has already designated this Beit Din to give his wife a get, well then sure she can just go and pick it up from them at any time, right? That's how that's in essence, as I understand what Rabbi Epstein was arguing, why this should work.
I mean, if he's around, he can say no. We'll
actually get to that in a bit, because you already established them. So there were three issues here that we're going to see somewhat recurring. One, or external politics. Here's how he's reporting in his experience. Right? It may be said that from preliminary conversations with leading Palestinian scholars, notice in 1930 he's using the term Palestinian, not Israel, right? I'm convinced that no serious objections will be raised by them to our theoretical treatment of the halakha. Certain modifications of the instrument may be suggested, certain flaws may be picked in the arguments, but nothing would seriously endanger the validity of the main thesis. This was either stated to me explicitly or was definitely implied by every rabbi with whom I discussed the subject. But just as liberal as I found them on the theoretical side, so reluctant, fearful, suspicious, reactionary did I find them on the side of the practical application of our thesis. The more liberal among them simply show a disinclination to be first on the list of those who seek reforms in Jewish law. They are afraid of their more conservative colleagues or opponents, but they indicate that when the movement is well on its way, they will join. See how little has changed since 1930. So one who was suspicious of my very coming to him, I labeled him a radical, said to me, it is your good fortune that I'm a man of calm temperament, or you would find yourself out of my house. Relying on favorable temperament, I stayed on and found him delightful company in a halachic discussion. But if I reverted back to my subject and asked him to tell me why he would not give consent to my proposal, the calm temperament would flare up with the explanation, "Please, say no more." Another rabbi of great fame argued in the following line. When America entered the war, it knew that with war would come widows and orphans and cripples. Yet in defense of our country and national honor, they took these things for granted. Our country and honor is our Torah. Why not take agunot for granted in defense of the Torah?
Wow.
Yeah. Now, he doesn't mention which rabbi that was, but it is kind of a despicable statement. You know, by all accounts. Like, yeah, you know, it's...
collateral damage.
Yeah, thank you. Collateral damage that we should be proud of. It's like, yeah, we're keeping the Torah by keeping these women chained to lives. Like, yeah, it's a badge of honor for us, because, like, whatever. So that was the opposition that he found. However, he also found opposition within conservative movement itself. In 1948, he delivered, in my opinion, one of the most... What? Well, this was all part of the rabbinical assembly, so I'll assume yes. And in 1948, he gave an epic rant against the Committee of Jewish Law and Standards, where he was, like, livid with how it worked. He said that they can say yes to everything and no to nothing, and for this, we don't need a committee, but a good pail and whitewash will do. He had a proposal that said that the Committee of Law and Standards would hold itself by the standard of Shulchan Aruch, being on the side of stringency or leniency, and it got voted down. But he was really ticked off at the time. And one of his complaints was, the committee has been blamed for many things which the rabbinical assembly and not the committee is responsible. It was not the committee that brought our effort on behalf of Aguna to end. It was the rabbinical assembly. In connection with the war, the committee formulated a ketubah clause to protect soldiers' wives should their husbands be reported missing in action. I should be ashamed to ask for a show of hands of how many of our members employed this device proposed by the committee. So the Orthodox didn't like it. It's clear that people in the conservative didn't like whatever proposal he had. Now, it might have been a slightly different proposal, but whatever solution was out there, according to Rabbi Epstein, you know, that they actually worked hard to come up with, wasn't being used.
Was this written after the driving?
I don't know. I'd have to remember. I think this is before the driving to Shul. I'm blanking on the year. I forget if the driving to Shul was 45 or in the 50s.
Yeah.
Shame. Should have remembered that. The halachic problem, though, and the truth is, regardless of what the rabbis told Rabbi Epstein, based on, again, it could be I'm misunderstanding his argument of setting up the shliach, setting up the Beit Din to be the agents. If that is what he did, I think there's an actual halachic problem, and I don't know which rabbis he spoke to or why they thought it was okay. And Stu picked up on this, in that the problem isn't so much, you know, once you set up the court as an agent, right? So first thing, according to Rambam, how this works is that a woman, this is Rambam, Laws of Divorce 6.5 and 6.30, doing a sentence from each. A woman is only divorced with a get sent through her husband's messenger or accepted by her own messenger until the get reaches her hand. So by doing this beforehand, she's still fully married, right? So that's not a problem. And a husband who sends a get to his wife is obligated to provide her monetary support and every condition of the marriage document until the get reaches her hand or of her designated agent. Right, so in that regard, you know what? Fine. You know, delay giving the get, you're still halachically married until the get comes in. The problem, though, based on Gemara in Gittin 33, is you could actually be mevatel, not the get itself. You don't have to nullify the get, but you can certainly nullify the agency. Rambam take this to another extreme. In Laws of Divorce 9.5, he argues that if a husband secludes himself with his wife after he tells them to write and sign a get and give it to her, they should not write the get. Why? And this is a logical inference, since if a get which was given to her is invalidated, and they seclude themselves, lest they have intercourse, it is logical that here they should not write the get, and if they wrote it and gave it to her afterwards, it was after they were secluded, it was not a get. So he's arguing, according to Rabbi, you know, Epstein's formulation, it goes completely against the Rambam, because he's making them agents to give a get to his wife on his behalf, and then they're going off and living like a married couple. So Rambam has an issue with that, and he says the get isn't valid at all. Rav Yosef Karo in the Kesef Mishnah, and I quoted here from Beit Yosef, Evan Ezer 1497, says that the logical inference that Maimonides is drawing isn't a logical inference at all, but he does say that you still have to be concerned about being the Vatel the Shlichut, about nullifying the agency, which is different than nullifying the get itself. Because the get at this point hasn't been written yet. If the get were written, it would have a problem of a get yashan, where if you know you have a get that's written, you know, signed, dated for a certain time, and then people have seclusion, then you know, then that becomes a problem with a get, because you know, person or you know, sort of whatever. I don't want to get into those details.
Are you still talking about the agents that are set up at the time of the marriage?
No, those are so according to Epstein, yes. Meaning, if I said, let's say, you know, I get married, right? Real hypothetical yeah. here. I say you as my agent to get. I say you as like you, like or you or if not you, you or your court. You're going to be my agents. You should write a get on my behalf and give it to my wife. All right, that's the scenario as I understand Rabbi Epstein. You haven't written the get yet. So if I'm so, which means I'm not being mevatel the get, because the problem of the gzera by Rabban Gamliel was once I sent you to give a get to the wife, the get's already been written. Right, and you're on your way to deliver it. Here, it hasn't been written yet. And I'm saying, you're my agent to go and write and deliver. But I can say, well, I am relieving you of your duty to write the get for my wife. And even the Shulchan Aruch says that's a concern. So what that means is, and the reason why I think this is a serious halakhic flaw in Rabbi Epstein's proposal, is that it doesn't help. I can just, you know, if I'm having, you know, whatever difficulties with my wife, before the Beit Din actually wrote it out, we can say, I'm being mevatel your shlichut. I'm nullifying your agency, you're no longer my agents. It's within my rights to do that. Mm-hmm. Right? It's not a permanent status that they have. So I don't know why no one brought that up. It could be someone did bring it up and I just didn't do enough research. But regardless, that I see as a fundamental flaw in Rabbi Epstein's position, because you can nullify the agency without nullifying the get, especially when the get hasn't been written.
Well, you're not missing.
What?
If this is written, and you know, maybe taking this too seriously, too literally, but it says, we apply ourselves to the court, and keeping in mind one objective, to invest the court with the power of granting a divorce to the wife without the consent and in the absence of the husband. So if the husband is actually absent, he can't invalidate the shulchan.
Oh, sure you can. You can, you can find some way of saying, you know, I'm relieving you of your duty.
Well, no, not if you're an MIA.
Yeah, you're right. I'm not saying that. It could be, this could work. If the husband doesn't do anything, you're fine. Right? But no, since...
In the specific instance,
this is only working in the case of an MIA. Between one and one, mm-hmm. two.
Ah.
So a soldier is missing.
And oh, I see.
You know his ship, a sailor, whatever. A guy is missing.
Yeah.
So if it only exists in the absence of the husband. So if the husband says, I invalidate you as a shulchan, he'd say, no, this only exists if you're absent. If you're here,
yeah,
then...
No. That's an interesting way of reading it. I see. So for the so you want to read it that it only applies to his focus is only to the MIA question.
I love my wife very much. I have no interest in setting up conditional, although we did what we did. I would be interested in it. I mean, like, if I were drafted off the war, I would go to Rome and say, what happens if I'm...
Well, get, you know, I thought about it...
Or how about a 9/11
situation? We'll talk about that a little bit. We'll talk about that a little bit later. I thought about including that. I actually took it out. Very briefly, there was, in fact, a get al tanai, conditional get, that was done in the time of David HaMelech, or at least as the Gemara reports. As Rashi explains it, the way it worked is, before you go off to war, you give your wife a get and saying, basically, you know, if I don't come home, you're divorced now. The way the Gemara does it, though, in context, isn't that like, oh, it's to prevent Aguna. It's a way of showing how when David HaMelech, you know, had an affair with Bathsheba, she wasn't technically married at the time. So it's a difficult Gemara from that perspective. But it does speak to the conditional side of the divorce thing, but you can do that differently. And in fact, that's kind of what my father's suggestion is. We can talk about this a little bit later. Where my father, we'll talk of giving a conditional divorce. Remind me, we'll get to that at the end. Because we have a few other things to go through. Here's where it gets a little to more commonly used solutions. One of the more famous attempts in the 20th century was the Lieberman Clause, named after Rabbi Saul Lieberman. And this is the text of the Lieberman Clause from the Proceedings of the Rabbinical Assembly from 1954. Stu, you want to read it for us?
And solemn assent to their mutual responsibilities and love, the bridegroom and bride have declared as evidence of our desire to enable each other to live in accordance with the Jewish law of marriage throughout our life that we, the bride and bridegroom, attach our signatures to the ketubah and hereby agree to recognize the Beit Din Rabbinical Assembly of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America, or its duly appointed representative, as having authority to counsel us in the light of the Jewish tradition, which requires husband and wife to give each other complete love and devotion, and to summon either party to request the other, or to enable the party so requested to live in accordance with the standards of the Jewish law of marriage, choose out the people of our lifetime. We authorize the Beit Din to impose such terms of compensation as it may seem fit for the failure to respond to its summons or to carry out its decision.
So the original text here, the effect of this is, this, by the way, when it's a clause, it's a, and it was written in Aramaic, and this is based on the translation they provide in 1954, that would actually be inserted into the ksuba itself, would be inserted into the marriage document. Okay, so how is this supposed to work? At the time of the marriage, you are designating the Beit Din of the Rabbinical Assembly to adjudicate your divorce and to impose any sort of fines or penalties. That's it in a nutshell. There's an alternate text that I found online, and it's a similar, it's slightly different language. Spouse may evoke annual remedies in civil law and equity to enforce compliance with the Beit Din's discussion obligation. The underlying part here, which we'll see, is the cause for major opposition, is authorizing the Beit Din to impose terms of compensation as it may see fit. So the first critique of this, by the way, of that particular line, didn't in fact come from the Orthodox. It came from the conservative themselves. In the proceedings of the Rabbinical Assembly, after they bring it up, there's a discussion that's recorded on this. And here's a critique by Rabbi Jacob Agus, who, of the things he's most well known for, is he co-wrote the responsa, the tshuva for conservative Judaism, permitting driving to synagogue on Shabbat. And here's his objection. He says, "Mr. Chairman, I feel this takana," and I put it in the Hebrew because that's how it's written in the proceedings. "I feel this takana is very important. I speak for a certain section of the Rabbinical Assembly, which, like Rabbi brackets William Greenfield, has its doubts about this takana. We feel, nevertheless, that it is a great step forward. However, there is one sentence in this formulation which I believe should be brought forth to this conversation for action, and that is the sentence for compensation. I have opposed it before, and I believe it will arouse the greatest amount of resentment when it is applied. I do not believe it is essential to the body of the takana. I should therefore like the steering committee to obtain the feeling of the members of the Rabbinical Assembly at this convention before it is applied. If the sentence is removed, I do not believe anybody will object to the takana." Now, we'll see there are a couple of issues for this, for the problem of compensation. One is that the reason why you want it there is that unless you agree that the Beit Din can fine you money, what's you to say, "I just don't care what the Beit Din has to say"? It's the only way that a Beit Din has any sort of teeth, because, it's kind of weird what people assume rabbis have power to do, but when you get right down to it, really not a whole lot. I don't control your life. Not that I would necessarily want to, except for, coming on time to shul. Nice little plug there. but aside from that, rabbis can't really do a whole lot, right? So in order to have that, a priori, assumption like, okay, we'll let you fine us, we're giving you that authority, what a Beit Din says, you can just as easily ignore. Maybe not halakhically, but also if you were so concerned halakhically, guy wouldn't withhold to give his wife a get. If he doesn't care about giving his wife a get, you can assume he's not going to care about other halakha too. Fine. So that was a critique already anticipated by Jacob Agus.
Would the ketubah have a, even if this clause was in it, would it have a would it have an effect in civil law as far as like being able to...
Beautiful question. That was discussed. These were huge, huge discussions there. Let's assume that it would be. So in terms of the Orthodox opposition, my source for this is Rabbi Norman Lamb, writing in Tradition in 1959. And he has, you know, a few arguments here. The Orthodox opposition to this innovation is based mainly on two factors. One is the competence of the proposed Beth Din, religious court, and the halachic validity of the amendment itself. The first matter is serious indeed. How can Orthodox Jews, or for that matter, any intellectually honest person, be expected to recognize the authority of an ecclesiastical court which denies, or at the very least seriously questions, the origin and hence authenticity of the very halacha in whose name it presumes to speak and whose tenets it seeks to interpret? So the first problem is that with the Lieberman Clause is that it states, go to the rabbinical assembly based in. And Rabbi Lamb is arguing that since the rabbinical assembly's basin is not halachic, how can we go to you? Now, it's important to recognize here that, yes, on one hand, this is, you know, you could say that this is just, you know, a part of the denominational politics that come up, that, well, we can't trust, you know, the basin. Though the truth is, on this particular charge, you know, I happen to think Rabbi Lamb had a very correct point. And the reason why I say that is, in the proceedings of the Rabbinical Assembly from 1954, in the chapter that immediately preceded the discussion on the Lieberman Clause, there was a discussion in which conservative Judaism, or at least the Rabbinical Assembly, basically concluded that it wasn't a... I'm trying to remember their exact phrase here. They did not have a problem if a rabbi married a kohen to a divorcee, which is not only a halachically prohibited marriage, but as we saw last week from the Gemara and Ketubot, is one of the few marriages that the Talmud says explicitly, you are kofeh, you are supposed to exert coercion on the husband to divorce the wife. And there they said, well, you know, technically the marriage is still chal, you know, it's still a halachically valid marriage, even though it's prohibited. And they seem to come up with some sort of, you know, dispensation for that. So for an Orthodox, you know, side to say, wait a sec, you know, he didn't cite that in particular. But given that you have such decisions that go, you know, violate straight Gemara and saying like, okay, you know, well, we're going to somehow be okay doing this, I think that itself is a legitimate concern. We'll talk about, you know, counters in a second, though. So that's one. The second... He also has an important line here that I wanted to include is, nevertheless, we shall in this essay restrict ourselves to the somewhat more impersonal and dispassionate second factor, the amendment proper. The leaders of Orthodoxy have stated unequivocally that the amendment is not halachically valid. Unfortunately, no detailed refutation by a competent scholar has been published to date. This essay, without laying claim to scholarly thoroughness, is an attempt to make good, in an elementary and popular manner, a debt that the Orthodox rabbinate owes to the Jewish American public. And I wanted to include that line specifically, because one, again, nothing has changed. It's very easy to say the ad hominem attack is like, oh yeah, they're wrong. Like, why is it wrong? People still do this today, and it's really annoying. Rabbi Lamb, at least, you know, just by saying this, acknowledges that, you know, it says there, it's a debt that the Orthodox rabbinate owes to the Jewish public. And unfortunately today, that's not a debt that many Orthodox rabbis really feel they share. That if you want to say something is wrong, that, or at least it's so patently obviously wrong that you can just dismiss it with a wave of a hand, it shouldn't be too difficult to come up with a logical, coherent argument to show why it's incorrect. So that's why I included that line. Because again, nothing has changed, and at least Rabbi Lamb recognizes that that's a flaw in Orthodox Jewish leadership, and he seeks to fix it. Here's where it gets a little bit tricky. So he tries to divide it up in different clauses. The first clause, he says, seems to be unnecessary and even somewhat amusing for throwing in that they conduct themselves in all the days of their life in the way of Torah. He just thought that was a superfluous, flowery type of language. That was an objection, but whatever. He says, acknowledges, though, there's an even more serious objection than irrelevancy or ineffectiveness. So if we accept the conservative amendment, then this clause becomes an integral part of the ketubah, the violation of which entails forfeiture of the rights of the ketubah by the violating spouse. Meaning, by including this in the ketubah, right, since these are conditions, and these are conditions that are part of a Jewish document, that involves also the acquisition through some sort of kinyan, there are going to be certain rules and regulations attached to it. So it gives, for instance, if the day after a wedding, the young bride in her first culinary venture should serve her husband a non-kosher dish, the husband would legally have a right upon suing for divorce at some later date to refuse to honor the financial obligations to his wife as stipulated in the ksuba because she did not, quote, enable him to live in, quote, the way of the Torah. So as he takes this very literally as a condition, when you set up conditions, you can set this up in any number of ways. You can say, well, you violated this clause, and therefore the whole ksuba is now forfeited, which, you know, is a fairly significant risk. I included a lot more of the text here. I don't think I'm going to be able to summarize this incredibly well. I'll try to do what I can just by the underlying piece. I'm going to have to... I'll fix this up here. Continuing in his article, there's a kind of contract which by its very nature precludes the complete and undivided focusing of and commitment to reliance on the term of the contract to the exclusion of any and all outside factors. This contract is such because of some element in it. It is improbable that there will be achieved the total psychological awareness of all the consequences of the matter. The element of unsureness or distraction is called, quote, asmachta, from the root samach memchav, which means to rely upon, i.e., there's an external factor which stimulates an unfounded overconfidence, a word which defies easy definition. And he goes through a discussion of this concept of an asmachta. He gives an example that I underlined here. Talmudic cases where the first party appoints the second to buy wine for him at a low price on condition that should he fail to do so, he must pay the first party the difference between the current and the lower price. Here, the fulfillment of the condition is only partially in the hands of the obligating party. It is up to him to offer to buy the wine, but it is up to the wine merchant to be willing to sell it to him, meaning it's not like a normal option, which is a real contract. Either one can frustrate the transaction. In this case, the entire contract is invalid as an asmachta, and the second party is not required to pay the difference. The reason for this is the element of distraction from overconfidence. He continues what I have here on the next page. Both parties are distracted from the prosaic consideration of the uncontrollable element, the independent behavior of the spouse. By overconfidence in the controllable element, the bride's or groom's own personal desire to make a success of their marriage venture. From this point of view, too, then, the contract is invalid because of asmachta. Trying to summarize a relatively complicated halakhic concept here, there's a certain degree of unsuredness in the contract itself that isn't well defined in terms of the assessment of financial penalties, and that's enough to invalidate the clause from a halakhic perspective. Okay? That is Rabbi Lamb's objection to the Lieberman clause, and later writing on this actually relies on Rabbi Lamb's writing. Okay, so that's the Lieberman clause, what it said, what it was supposed to do, and the Orthodox objection. Now here's where it gets real fun. You fast forward a little bit later, we have something called the halachic prenup. Dan, could you read for us? This is from the origins of the prenup, a section on a website. Now this used to be a subsection of the Rabbinical Council of America's website that since launched into its own. It's called theprenup.org. It's a website dedicated specifically to the halachic prenup. Here's an excerpt from that.
The prenup was drafted by Rabbi Mordechai Willig, Sganav Beit Din of the Beit Din of America, and the Rosh Yeshiva of Rabbi at Reitz consultation with halachic and legal experts. The concepts contained in the prenup predate 1994 when it was introduced. In 1664, Rav Shmuel ben David Moshe Halevi, the rabbi of Bamberg, Germany, published a compilation of Jewish legal forms called the Nachalas Shiva. One of the forms in that book is a version of the Tanaim, a Jewish wedding document, with a provision that is very similar to the prenup. In a footnote to that provision, the Nachalas Shiva cites some authorities who held that the provision dates back to the Takanos Shum, the authoritative communal enactments adopted in the early Middle Ages by the leaders of the German communities of Speyer, Worms, and Mayence.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I actually have, in the next section, I'm not sure if I might move it around a bit. Let's just do it in order here. So here's the text of the halachic prenup itself. There are a bunch of different clauses. So first point is, should a dispute arise between the parties after they are married, they don't live together as husband and wife, they agree to refer their marital dispute to the Beit Din of the United States of America, Incorporated, currently located wherever, acting as an arbitration panel for a binding decision. So really, this halachic prenup is... an agreement a priori to binding arbitration to the... this is the Beit Din of America. In theory, you could substitute any... Well, not any Beit Din, but we're just going to use the Beit Din of America here. Two, the Beit Din of America... decision of the Beit Din of America shall be enforceable in any court of competent jurisdiction. Section 3 says that parties that has exclusive jurisdiction to decide all issues related to a get, as well as any other issues from ketubah or tana'im entered by the husband and wife-to-be. There's another section where the husband and wife can give the Beit Din more authority. The default is just the get. But a couple can also say, we want the Beit Din to take care of custody and property. All right, but those parts are optional. 5, here's a clutch part. Failure of either party to perform his or her obligation under this agreement shall make that party liable for all costs awarded by either the Beit Din of America or a court of competent jurisdiction, including reasonable attorney's fees incurred by one side in order to obtain the other party's performance in terms of this agreement. And then there's the thing about how it's going to be made in accordance with law, Pshara Kruv al-Adin, kind of reiterated in Section 7 here, that the parties agree to appear in person before the Beit Din of America at the demand of the other party, and to cooperate with the adjudication of the Beit Din of America in every way and manner. In the event of the failure of either party to appear before the Beit Din of America upon reasonable notice, the Beit Din of America may issue its decision despite defaulting parties' failure to appear and may impose costs and other penalties as legally permitted. Basically, the way that this works is, again, to provide a stis, you agree a priori through this binding arbitration that in these certain cases, you agree to go to the Beit Din of America. Beit Din of America now has legally binding arbitration power over you, which means they can tell either party to do whatever, and once that gets into the court, it is now enforceable by the civil courts. Right, because that's how it has teeth. You don't have to listen to a Beit Din. Mm-hmm. And this, in fact, the various... the components of this have, in fact, been defended in civil courts. There's one case that I have a PDF of where the Beit Din actually had imposed something like $100,000 fines on the husband. And the av of the Beit Din, the head, reduced it to $10,000. And the wife went to secular court and said, but here was the decision of the Beit Din. And the court said, well, you agreed to go through this organization for binding arbitration. And according to their rules, the head can, in fact, overturn the decisions of a lower court, of the court that, you know, actually adjudicated. So it's fine. But it meant that the basic essence of the binding arbitration nature of the prenup has been, in fact, sustained in the secular court. And, it hasn't been tested that often, but what little has been seemed to reaffirm this. So what this enables you to do is say, well, I'm, my husband's not giving me a get. We have this halachic prenup. You go to a Beit Din. Beit Din can say, well, you already agreed to give us binding arbitration power. Give your wife a get in a certain amount of time, or we're going to fine you, let's say, $15,000 or however much, depending on how much, the guy has. Right? And if the guy says, I don't have to listen to the Beit Din, since you have the legally binding arbitration agreement, they can now take that to civil court and say, hey, we have a binding arbitration agreement signed and legal. Civil court can now start enforcing penalties. So when you think about certain limitations about the halachic prenup, are one, it doesn't help the MIA or diminished capacity case. And two, as it's written, only really works in America. Right, because this is based specifically on America. I know that there's been effort to get something comparable done for Canada, but you would really have to have it phrased in such a way that in each country, however the binding arbitration laws work, however the binding law, be okay for them.
As long as you specify who they were.
Well, because you do it not to the individuals, but you do it to the institution.
So it has to be a continuing.
Well, you assume that the Beit Din of America isn't going to go bankrupt and go poof. In theory, it could, but there's less of a likely of them disbanding than of individuals that you mentioned passing away or being inaccessible. Right, that's an advantage of going to a fixed Beit Din where you don't mention the individuals by name. You're going to the body. And this halachic prenup was, I mean, I don't know exactly how the dates were, because according to what Dan read, it says that it was introduced in 1994. But I have here from the Rabbinical Council of America an endorsement dated June 1st, 1993. So the dates are probably give or take a year, like when it was proposed and when it was formally introduced. But basically it had the backing of the Rabbinical Council of America in 1993 and still does. Turn to page what I have on section 10 here. And here's where it gets incredibly infuriating. If you paid close attention, the distinctions between the Lieberman Clause and the Halachic Prenup aren't that great. Years introduced, right? One, Lieberman Clause was 1954, Halachic Prenup 1994. So you're talking about a 40-year difference. What is the real difference between the Halachic Prenup and the Binding Halachic Prenup and the Lieberman Clause? Right, so one, the Jewish Beit Din / the Jewish court. Here are direct quotes from the passages. Just want to give it to you side by side. Lieberman Clause had the Beit Din of Rabbinical Assembly and the Jewish Theological Seminary of America or its duly appointed representatives. Halachic Prenup is Beit Din of the United States of America. Enforcement / penalties. What did the Lieberman Clause say? Quote, we authorize the Beit Din to impose such terms of compensation as it may see fit for failure to respond to its summons or to carry out its decision. What did the Halachic Prenup say? Failure of either party to perform his or her obligations under this agreement shall make that party liable for all costs awarded by either Beit Din of America or a court of competent jurisdiction, including reasonable attorney's fees incurred by one side in order to retain the other party's performance in terms of this agreement. And also, again, quote, in the event of failure of either party to appear before the Beit Din of America upon reasonable notice.
It's legally more specific language, though. I mean, that does count.
Legally more specific? In which way? One second, let me just finish that last line here. May issue its decision despite defaulting parties' failure to appear and may impose costs and other penalties as legally permitted. And in terms of Orthodox acceptance, whereas the Lieberman Clause was rejected by Orthodox Judaism, the Halachic Prenup was endorsed by the Rabbinical Council of America, several prominent rabbis individually, and it is currently a requirement of all Yeshivat Chovevei Torah graduates, where anyone who gets smicha from YCT has to use the Halachic Prenup for any marriage they do. It's a condition of their ordination. And there still is opposition from some circles. So, the differences between these two. You may be able to find, some of... wait a second. I skipped that part. The first one that I had here is document, right? The Lieberman Clause was integrated into the ketubah itself. The Halachic Prenup is an independent document of binding arbitration. Okay? Substantively, you tell me the real if I'm missing out any other real difference.
Well, when it comes to something being legally binding,
yeah,
the form is the substance a lot of the time. So you can't say that just because something means the same thing, that it's not more presentable in a court of law.
True. So you're arguing in terms of would a civil court be able to enforce it?
Right.
If perhaps. But that wasn't the argument. The argument from the Orthodox wasn't what's enforceable in a secular court. It's what's valid halachically. No one says, like, oh, we're not going to use it because it's not enforceable. They said, this is a halachic problem.
Oh, so that's what you're arguing.
Yes. And here's where I get really ticked off. The difference is, the differences between them. Is it in the ksuba itself, or is it a separate document? Which base did you use, right? Beyond that, these are almost trivial. And it took 40 years to get there, right? You couldn't imagine if the Orthodox rabbinate was that smart, had that many gedolim back in the day, they couldn't have figured this out and were just like, well, that part doesn't work, so why don't we just do it this way? Like, seriously? All right? And this is, I think, this is an indictment, really, of Orthodox Judaism at the time, when you prioritize the denominational politics over the plight of the Agunot. there was a member of the shul who said she was at a lecture from Rav Soloveitchik back in the day, who said the main problem with the Lieberman Clause was that it came from the conservatives. And we saw a bit of that in the Politics of Exclusion series. You don't think, like, were people not smart back then, that even if you thought that all of that was puzzle, to get from column A to column B should not have taken 40 years? Right? These seem to be relatively trivial distinctions. Your problem that it's in the Ksuba, okay, so write a separate document. You don't like the rabbinical assembly's base then? Fine, use a different base then. Really, that's what you're going to get so hung up on? Just, you know, do it similarly, but do it differently. But I think it was because, you know, there was so much of the threat at that time. You did it, the Orthodox rabbinate didn't want to give any shred of, you know, respect or acknowledgement to any sort of validity that came out of conservative Judaism. And so, I mean, look, according to the Halakha Prenup site, this stuff dated back to 1664. So how come it wasn't used in place, you know, until then? Right? Which is, I think, another very valid question.
Well,
right?
I mean, there seemed to be, like, not enough, what we call political will to actually grapple. I mean, were people grappling with the problem heavily during these 40 years? Or they were just like,
I don't know, but I think the fact that conservative Judaism, like, you know, when Rabbi Epstein's taking the lead on this in 1930, right, it might be a good reason to do so, but if the wrong side decides to look it up first, right,
then the whole thing becomes like...
Yeah, and to, you know, even Epstein and Rabbi Epstein in the 30s conceded that they needed to do a better PR job and needed to get people back into, you know, and really needed to get people... whatchamacallit, you know, on their side before they institute such a thing. Yes, politics does come into play. This little chart over here shows just how pathetic that is.
Yeah.
Right? Because it took 40 years to get from column A to column B for things that I think a rational person who is, you know, dispassionate is like, wait, looking at it just in terms of content, this is trivial. Like, I'm fine saying I am not nearly as smart as, you know, people back then, which mean they ought to have been able to think about this and to come up with a better solution, and chose not to. Because if... Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
It may also be an issue of who's affected by this. I have been to the Beit Din of America. The only women I saw there were secretaries.
Yeah. Well, women aren't going to serve on a Beit Din.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the people who are making these decisions are not affected by it, and so it's not a priority for them, what happens to women. I think there's a huge... Maybe not.
If it would have come from the Orthodox or the acceptable people first, it would have had a much... It's like, oh, we have to take care of this. It has more... That's why I was very careful with that. It's when the denominational politics takes precedent over the needs of the women. Even like if the right people said so, I don't think there would be nearly as much of a problem.
Right, but also how many Orthodox were going off to war?
But it wasn't just war. I mean, there are three types of agunot.
Yes, yeah.
But again, this is recalcitrant husband. The halachic prenup is ineffective if you have an MIA.
Right.
And you, but I call that more of a limitation than a flaw. Here's an actual potential flaw in the halachic prenup, which unfortunately doesn't get discussed as much. And that is, what the halachic prenup does is, binding arbitration to a particular beit din, that assumes, in order for it to be effective, that the beit din is competent, and ideally has integrity. That's not a given at all. And for this, I'm going to get a little bit careful here because it's somewhat of a controversial topic here. Sam, I hope you don't have to leave with this. This is actually, you know, going to get good. One of the most well-publicized Aguna cases today is that between Aaron Friedman and Tamar Epstein. And one of the reasons why it's gotten so much prominence is Aaron Friedman is a congressional aide to Representative David Kemp. And there's been not just protests for, you know, Aaron Friedman himself and his family, like not just family, but other supporters, but have actually gone to protest the congressman himself. As his Facebook page was recently, like he just set up a Facebook fan page, inundated with things about, tell Aaron Friedman to give his wife again. It was taken down. So here's where it gets, you know, here's where we see how it gets somewhat complicated. Rabbi Barry Freundel, writing for the Washington Jewish Week on January 12, 2011, says that when he describes, you know, giving background to this particular case, says that, you know, it is not the usual Aguna case, even contemporary variety. Usually in these cases, a husband is summoned to a court and refuses to comply. That leads to a siruv, which is basically a document of kind of putting someone in cherem for contempt of court. And to what should be a virtually unanimous decision by community to reject protest and pressure the recalcitrant husband to receive the get. But that is not the case here. These two people were before a Beit Din in Baltimore. In fact, they both signed that this court would adjudicate the issues between them, including the get. For whatever reason, after presenting this the case, but before a verdict, they both took some of the issues to secular court, a violation of Jewish law, and those issues were decided in that tribunal. However, the get was not and could be adjudicated in that forum. At this time, again speaking January 12, 2011, the Baltimore Beit Din is willing to continue the case, or by mutual consent of the parties, allow it to go to another Beit Din. One or the other of the parties has not yet accepted these possible solutions that might well move the process forward to a conclusion. Meaning this big Aguna case that's made all the press started off in Beit Din. Here's the Siruv, the one that's currently in effect, from the Union of Orthodox Rabbis of the United States and Canada, is that he is in fact in Siruv because, as I underlined here, he was requested to appear before a Beit Din for a final adjudication on the matter of his refusal as well as other matters, but refused to even respond to their request. So something happened at some point, right, that a second Beit Din got involved and issued a seir for not going to that Beit Din. Turn the page to the next source. You have one of the later... this was written after that seruv to the members of the Washington, D.C. Jewish community. This is a letter from the Vad HaRabbanim of Greater Washington, Incorporated. Several months ago, a very difficult situation involving the unfortunate breakdown of the marital relationship between Aaron Friedman and Tamar Epstein became public within our community. At that time, the Vad, after careful and thorough consideration, determined 1, the dispute was pending before the Baltimore Beit Din; 2, that the Baltimore Beit Din had retained its jurisdiction over the matter; and 3, that no seruv order had been issued declaring Mr. Friedman in breach of the orders of the Beit Din. Accordingly, we indicated at that time that the circumstances did not warrant our declaring Mr. Epstein, the declaring of Miss Epstein, I should say, an Aguna. Since that time, there have been new developments, most notably the issuance of a seruv against Mr. Friedman by the Beit Din of the Union of Orthodox Rabbis in Canada, which now has jurisdiction over the matter. So, summarize here, they started in the Beit Din of Baltimore, something happened, and now I'm trying to be very careful here based on what I have from the documented evidence. I did get filled in a little bit on the some of the details, and it's really complicated. But my point here, why I include this, is that the case originated in Beit Din, and the Baltimore Beit Din that initially had it, to put it frankly, didn't do its job. By going to a secular court, either they should have put their foot down and issued a seruv there, or at least retained the authority to force Aaron to give his wife a get. Something happened such that they gave up jurisdiction. We're not going to argue now about the other, you know, Beit Din where they came into play. Here is an endorsement of Rabbi Herschel Schachter to force him to give his wife a get. Now note that this was dated December in 2010. Right? That was the time that this letter was dated. Where he writes that... in order to prevent a husband from causing a wife to an aguna, this matter does not require a ruling from a Beit Din, and it is obvious that an instruction is sufficient. Fast-forwarding down the line, if the sage Rabbi Shmuel Kamenetsky, who is one of the people who signed the seruv, which, by the way, was dated later... So if the sage Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky instructed that it is proper to pressure the husband to divorce his wife, then this wise elder has issued his instruction. And one cannot ignore his instruction, because if so, one has to judge every single Beit Din that has stood from the time of Moshe until now. So the problem here is at the time of this writing, ostensibly, it's still, well, I don't know if it actually had begun in the case of the Baltimore Beit Din. Rav Schachter's arguing that all you need is one person, or at least one great rabbi, one gadol, to say, give your wife a get, you don't really need the Beit Din. And if you question it, then you're questioning every single Beit Din. So, in truth, if this letter came out after it already was in the court, the Baltimore Beit Din, then this would be an absolutely meaningless line, because they actually did go to Beit Din, and one rabbi elsewhere has no right to say, do this when it's actually in court. Otherwise, that effect delegitimize the entire Beis Din, right? Mm-hmm. Furthermore, you know, turning the page, you know, Rav Schechter himself, you know, is not a fan of many Batei Din that are out there. The context here is, you know, more of the civil cases, but you'll see, you know, that how much of this could be applied to divorce cases as well. This was originally published in Ami magazine. There's a link here to where it's up on the site, Vos is Nice. He's question, would you call then the problem in the Beis Din system a crisis? It's worse than a crisis. They tell me there's a prominent Talmid Chacham in Flatbush who tells his Balei Batin to go to a secular court because they stand a better chance of getting Yashar justice than in a Goyish and non-Jewish court than in a Din Torah. If you ask him, he'll deny it, but that's what he tells people. Unfortunately, I think the comment about Yashar is true. Question, do you have a problem with the Borerim system in which two of the Dayanim are chosen by litigants and the two Dayanim choose a third? Answer, the Borerim system is also a Shanda. A lot of the Borerim act like Toanim, advocates. I was involved in a Din Torah. The Borer took Shochad, bribes. I had to resign from the case. He felt insulted. It was before Rosh Hashanah and he told me he was not going to be Mochel, forgive me. I told him, I don't need Mechila. You took Shochad. You're puzzled to be a Dayan. It says in Shulchan Aruch that you can have one litigant pay his dayan and the other pay his dayan, unless, which Rav Moshe writes in a tshuva, it is clear that both are being paid the same amount, in which case one can pay his dayan and they both pay the third. But that isn't what happens. They don't pay the same amount. The payment depends on how long each one bothers the dayan, so they don't pay the same amount. And it is true shochad, meaning bribery. You meet question. You mean they're not allowed to charge for the private sessions as well? Answer. Of course not. That's shochad. They pay more money for private sessions, and then the dayan, instead of talking like a dayan, talks like a toy. I was once involved in a Din Torah. One of the dayanim was making up his mind. This side is wealthier than the other, so let him pay. What way to talk is that? A Din Torah of a penny is to be treated like a Din Torah of $1 million. Question, are you saying there's a problem with the Dayanim? Answer, of course. Do you think that all of the Dayanim are honest? Many are acting like Toanim. Many of the Toanim are acting like criminals. They make up their minds in advance that their side has to win. So a potential flaw of the halachic prenup, you know, as for whatever problems it solves, is that the validity, well, not the validity, but the efficacy and the matter of justice is entirely conditional on the integrity of the Beit Din that is listed therein. In theory, you could substitute the Beit Din of America, fine. But even when you have something like the Beit Din of America, which is a body, like it's a fixed institution, let's say today no one has any complaints on any dayan on the Beit Din of America. What's going to happen 50 years from now? I'm not saying that it is an intrinsically corrupt institution, but far from it. What I am saying is that it is a risk and it is a concern that people have to be aware of, that there is a possibility of individuals who are unethical, right, who do in fact get on a Beit Din, and just because you agree to have them adjudicate doesn't mean necessarily that you're going to get justice. The Baltimore Beis Din that was supposed to adjudicate a get screwed up, and screwed up royally. And it actually facilitated this person, you know, having the agunah. Now, maybe having the, you know, the halachic prenup might have given it a little bit more teeth to enforce. But if they don't actually do their job, it's not really going to matter. So I consider that sort of a quasi, I want to call it an intrinsic flaw in the prenup system, but it is certainly a concern. So, you know, of the solutions that we've seen Hafka'at Kiddushin, a bit of the debate about that. We saw Rabbi Epstein's solution, more, you know, significant halachic problems there. We saw a comparison between the Lieberman clause and the halachic prenup, and how, you know, the distinctions there, practically speaking, they're, for all intents and purposes, the same basic mechanism, but, you know, my speculation is due to the denominational politics, it took 40 years for Orthodox to come up with their own way and pretend like, you know, the Lieberman clause had nothing to do with it and how this is. It's a weird way of saying, like, on one hand, you want to say, like, it's our great innovation, but also say it's part of the tradition. Say it's like, oh, it really goes back to 1664, right? You know, but it's going to be our, you know, implementation, like, go us. But even with that, you know, there is a concern for going to a Beit Din that you can trust. And if not the individuals on the Beit Din, then at least the system or the culture of that Beit Din, whatever it might be. Any questions? Sorry for monopolizing it, but you realize there was a whole lot of stuff to go through and, you know, we ran a bit, you know, slightly over. Any questions that people have right now or anything that people want to discuss?
I don't know. I have a bunch of things.
Go for it. Understood. Thank you so much.
Sure, thanks.
You got this source sheet?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The clause that Lamb objected to, wasn't that taken out in the
No. That clause stayed in. I mean, the clause about
devotion, living a life of Torah.
Oh, was that taken? You know, it would be funny if they took, because if they took it out and say, "Ah, oh, it shows that you don't want to live a life of Torah." Right. I don't know. I mean, the alternate.
That was what Lamb objected to?
That was one of his objections,
yeah, right.
But he acknowledged that that wasn't a serious objection.
Okay.
Meaning, it's like that was more of a humble. Yeah, he acknowledged that wasn't a substantive objection to say, like, you could say it's like he said it's irrelevant, it's unnecessary. He said it was amusing, right? But just having that there doesn't make it puzzle, okay. Right? In the alternate texture, it's, you know, phrased a little bit differently, but that's, yeah. What else?
Could you mind if I use one of the plastic bags?
Go ahead. I got plenty.
Okay. I just wanted to take my
phone.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. It could be that the 40-year gap, the 40-year delay, had to do with the pressure from their own constituency. That there was more of this stuff arising, and that women acquired a louder voice.
Which is equally, well, there were, there were definitely Aguna cases before this. Some were very well publicized. Aguna is not a new issue.
No, but the magnitude, in other words,
3,000 years, at least.
All right.
They may have felt that they were now facing a revolt.
In which case, then I have to seriously question, the leadership as well. Right. Meaning, you don't think it's a problem until it's like, it may not have gotten as much press, but if that's what requires, that's what you need to get rabbis to act, is a lot of negative publicity. And we didn't even discuss here the 1992 New York get law, because that wasn't really a halachic thing as much. We had enough stuff to deal with. I figured that was something that had to go by the wayside. Oh, which reminds me, before we get to the other questions, my father's solution. His solution was, at the time of the wedding, give the wife a get, at the wedding, that says, you are divorced starting from now if the following condition is met, and it'd be something like, if, we don't live together for 2 years. Now, a get al tanai, conditional get, is clearly valid in the Gemara, and clearly that would work, right? And that would actually solve a bunch of the problems. However, you'd have other problems. Big one being, if you have a scenario where, and you could also just not do it in these cases, but let's say it's a kohen, let's say it's a priest that's married, and he has that clause there, and let's say he's an MIA, he can't come home from 2 years, or he's imprisoned, either legally, illegally, in some random country, and he can't come home for 2 years, then the condition of the divorce would take effect. He'd be divorced from his wife, and wouldn't halakhically be allowed to remarry, right? Yeah. If it would be any other person in that situation, you're halakhically divorced. You want to get remarried? Get remarried. But if it's Cohen, no.
As long as she hasn't married anyone in between.
Correct. Right. As long as she didn't get married to anyone else in between. So, but at least then you could say, well, the woman, went along with it and was fine. But you could have a case where, let's say a husband's wrongly in prison, the woman's fighting for her, fighting for her. Unless they have some sort of conjugal visit, that can sort of fulfill the condition. It works. The two issues, it's not going to get wide acceptance because no one's going to write a divorce at their wedding. But that is a risk. I would consider that, not so much a flaw as much as a huge concern. So, yeah, thank you for reminding me of that. Yeah.
The last thing is, did Soloveitchik have more of a role in the Lieberman controversy than you've indicated?
That we covered a bit in the Politics of Exclusion class. Mark Shapiro writes that a bit, where he basically, there was an attempt to have a joint beitin of Orthodox and conservative, and the Orthodox nixed that completely. So the answer is more than I mentioned here, but go back to those classes where it actually discusses, because that could have solved the problem. It's the Orthodox that said, we don't want anything to do with you. They could have had a portion in there, and they could have, think about it. In 40 years, how many Aguno could have been helped? And due to politics, you decided willingly not to. Yeah. Kind of, yeah. So, when I have those statements, when I say that, the conservative Beit Din, I understand why a halachic Jew wouldn't want to rely on them. Isn't just me showing for Orthodox over conservative. It's not that Israeli Trevor like that, was a legitimate complaint, given that the Beit Din, kind of went against a bunch of other halachot. But on the other hand, it's not just pure whatever Orthodox Jews do is right and proper. Right? And this is, I think, a really unfortunate, sad case where the denominational politics got in the way of doing real good. Right? And you saw the chart there, distinctions are just based on the quotes. If that took you 40 years to do, right, it means that someone should have been smart enough to do a better job of it back then. And the fact that they didn't is, I think it's something that if people have, this is an area where if people want to yell at Orthodox Jews for, or Orthodox Jewish institutions for, the Aguna issue, that's a pretty big indictment. You can do that one, and you could also do failure of Batei Din to do their job, because both of those are documented. Right? All right. So, have a wonderful week. All right.